I'm Melinda Pencava with the World Vision Report. In northeastern Kenya, it hasn't rained in almost a year. Everyone is struggling to survive, even the camels.
During this kind of drought, if the drought is persistent, the camels sit. And when you see a camel sitting, you know its situation is very pathetic.
In Ivory Coast, the president has lost the election, but still won't step down. Refugees are fleeing to Liberia, where perfect strangers are hosting them. And move over Red Bull. In Mexico, the Tarahumara people drink pinole.
It's good for the stomach, and it helps you walk and everything. If you don't drink it, then you're not motivated to run or even to move a muscle.
Around the world with the World Vision Report, but first this news. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Melinda Pencava, sitting in for Peggy Waymeyer. Protests brought down the Tunisian government recently, sparked by several things: repressive government policies, joblessness, and corruption. And the rise in the price of food was another reason. This is a recurring theme in other protests we're seeing in the region, in Algeria, Egypt, and Yemen. The UN Food and Agricultural Organization, or FAO, says that food prices are the highest they've been since the food riots of 2008. Michael Clare recently wrote an article in Salon magazine called "Welcome to the Year of Living Dangerously." And Michael Clare, welcome to you. Thanks for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
So the FAO is warning about rising food prices. Where in the developing world is this going to be a significant problem?
My guess is it'll be a problem everywhere in the developing world because so many people in the poorer parts of the world depend on a handful of staple crops, wheat, corn, rice. And if the prices of those, if they double, as they have, then the cost of simply feeding themselves every day is going to become exceedingly difficult. And this will create great hardship and I'm sure will produce a lot of anxiety and anger.
Now, what would you say is the major cause of this rise in the cost of grains, these food staples?
You have a number of things going on at once. Certainly, we've had a number of extreme weather events lately. We've had intense flooding in Australia. Australia is a major grain producer. There's been extreme drought in Argentina. These countries are in the southern hemisphere. This is their summer, and they're major summer food producers. But there are also early signs that crops in the northern hemisphere in the United States and elsewhere are at risk. And we still have the legacy from last summer's extreme drought, crippling drought in Russia and Ukraine, where one-third of the wheat crop was destroyed. In addition to that, you have a rising demand for food as population grows and as people become wealthier. You have people getting richer in many areas in China and India or rising to the middle class, and they eat more meat and poultry. A lot of that's fed by grains, so they're driving up the prices as well.
What has been a response so far? How are countries reacting to these increasing costs?
Some countries are taking extreme measures. Some countries, like Russia, have banned exports of food because they're fearful that their own population will be denied access to food in the future. Other countries are buying up food as much as they can and stockpiling it in anticipation of shortages later this year.
Is there a risk that any of those measures could contribute to the food crisis too?
Yes, indeed. For example, countries which ban exports could make the price of food in international markets higher, and this will hurt countries like the Philippines and Egypt that depend on food imports. They will be at risk because they'll have to pay higher prices for whatever grains and other foods are available on the marketplace. And if there is a reduction in the amount of food available in the marketplace, prices will rise.
It sounds as though what you're saying is there is enough food, but it may just be out of reach financially for many people.
That's it exactly. probably if everybody was to have access to a minimum amount of food, there would be enough in the world available. It's not that there's an extreme shortage of food, but there is competition for what's available, and people with a wealthier diet, bigger pockets, are able to pay more for it, and that's driving up the prices at a time when there are some shortages. So poor people are not able to pay the higher prices, and they're going to experience food shortages.
Food wasn't the only reason that protesters toppled the Tunisian government, but in 2008, we saw food riots around the world, and the costs are hitting those levels now, and they're getting higher. Do you see what happened in northern Africa spreading to other parts of the world?
Oh, yes. I think we're going to see protests and maybe riots about rising food in many parts of the world.
We've been talking a lot about the price of food. I'm wondering if you see in the immediate future an actual lack of food.
Well, again, the problem is not going to be a actual lack of food per se, so far as I could tell, but insufficient amounts at prices that poor people and lower income people can afford. Now, that said, we've seen a lot of very extreme weather events in the past few months, in the past year. And many of us believe, I certainly believe, that this is a consequence of global climate change, because climate change does cause a lot of extreme weather events, more hurricanes, more floods, more typhoons. And if that pattern continues and increases, it is going to destroy a lot of food-producing areas around the world. And that could lead, in time, to the destruction of cropland and the destruction of food on a scale that we've never seen before.
Michael Clare, thanks for joining us.
It's been my pleasure.
Michael Clare is a professor of peace and world security studies at Hampshire College and the author of the books Resource Wars and Blood and Oil. You can read his Salon article at worldvisionreport.org. When it gets so dry and hot that even the camels are too weak to stand up, herders start to worry. That's how it is in northeast Kenya. Rain has not fallen for nearly a year, and the animals have begun to die. Many fear it is the start of a devastating drought. Nick Wadhams reports from the town of Wajir.
The heat is too much, even for the camels. They seek relief under a tree just outside Wajir, a city of 50,000 people. Wajir lies in the sun-blasted desert of northeast Kenya near the border with Somalia. The last time it rained here was March 2010. Normally, the region receives so-called short rains in December and January, but they never came. Now, the herders who raise goats, cattle, and camels fear that even if the annual long rains arrive on time in March and April, they will be too late to save their herds. Herder Farah Hussein has brought his goats to a borehole where men dump buckets of well water into a trough for their animals. He says his herd of 80 goats is dwindling fast.
Many goats are dying, and many more will die. I had to leave some at home because they didn't have enough strength to come here.
The drought has withered the little pasture that exists around Wajir, so animals have nothing to forage on. Hussein Hassan is a community leader in the nearby town of Hassan Yaro. He says it's gotten so bad the animals aren't giving much milk anymore.
During this kind of drought, if the drought is persistent, the camels sit. And when you see a camel sitting, you know its situation is very pathetic.
The Wajir region has been hit by drought many times in the past. 2009 was also bad. But people say a situation like this, when the short rains fail completely, is extremely rare. They say the weather patterns are no longer predictable. Some attribute this to climate change, others to a string of bad years.
people and their livelihood are not able to get. That's basic need, which is a right.
Behind a line of stalls in Hassan Yero, a group of men gather around a car listening to a Kenyan radio station. It's broadcasting a live parliamentary debate about the drought, which is hitting all of Kenya hard this year. Local politicians are demanding more action from their government, but so far it has done little to address the crisis. One aid group, Save the Children UK, is trying to ease the crisis in the Wajir area. It's buying meat and milk before the animals die and herders lose their only source of income. The food is then handed out to designated families. At one of the stalls back in Hassan Yaro, butcher Bashir Abdullahi slices bright red chunks of camel meat. He distributes the meat for free to those who present specially issued vouchers from Save the Children. But the program, as helpful as it is, only serves a small number of the growing population of hungry people around Wajir. And the need for food is getting more desperate, says Muna Ahmed, who works with a local aid group that partners with Save the Children.
Everything is getting tough for these people, and now they entirely depend on the relief food. And there's so many people losing their livestock, and they just have to come to town. And, you know, new settlements coming up and all that. Because people have lost their livelihood. They don't have anything else to depend on.
In the desert settlement of Magag, outside Wajir, two nurses sit at rusted metal tables dispensing antibiotics and vaccinations to people who trickle out of the bush. This is a monthly mobile health outreach center. The nurses say that about half the children who come here show signs of being malnourished, and the women who gather here say they're not getting enough food. Abdia Mukhtar, 65, says she has seven children and lost four others when they were just infants.
We don't have much food. The amount that we get in aid isn't enough. What we're given, we're sharing. And now we're starting to go without food.
By early afternoon, the sun beats down on Wajir. The heat is crushing. As they lay bricks, two construction workers sing folk songs to ward off the exhaustion. They are among the very few who remain outside at this hour. But they are lucky to have work. For most here, the main source of income is the animals. So, for now, all people can do is hope that their livestock can hang on until the long rains come again. If they do indeed come again, 2 months from now. For the World Vision Report, this is Nick Wadhams in Wajir, Kenya.
There's an exodus from Ivory Coast in the wake of last month's election there. That story next on the World Vision Report. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Melinda Penkava. The Ivory Coast is a country split down the middle. In November, President Laurent Gbagbo lost the election to his rival, Alassane Ouattara. But 2 months later, Gbagbo still refuses to step down. Human rights groups say he's unleashed a campaign of violence, and thousands of Ivorians from both sides are fleeing their homes. Most of them are going to neighboring Liberia, a poor country still recovering from its own long and bloody civil war. Tamison Ford reports from the Liberian border, where more than 30,000 Ivorian refugees have arrived.
Der Elise crouches on a small tree stump. Under the shade of the village's community hut, she cradles her little boy in her arms. With his tiny frame, he looks more like a newborn than a one-year-old. Elise fled Ivory Coast with seven of her nine children. Fearing for their lives, she left her cocoa farm along with everything she owns and came here to Kisiple, a small town in northeastern Liberia, not far from the Ivorian border. 40 of her extended family are with her. They are all supporters of the sitting president, Laurent Gbagbo.
I fled because one of my brothers was beaten by the rebels in
All of us voted for Gbagbo. That's the reason why we fled. When I arrived, the town chief gave me a little place, a little hut for my children and myself, including the rest of his family. This is where we are living now.
There are also refugees here who voted for Gbagbo's opponent, Alassane Ouattara. Albertine Yawa walked for 3 days in her slippers through forests and over broken bridges to reach Liberia. She's here with her husband and 2 children.
In my village, while we were voting, Gbagbo people came to force us to vote for them. And then Ouattara people would come and force you to vote for them. That's why I got scared and I came.
Dodo Eliz and Albertine Yawa voted for different leaders. They do share something in common, a need for basic necessities. More than 15 people are crammed into this hut where Eliz sleeps every night. It's the same situation for thousands of other Ivorians. They are all being hosted by Liberian families. That puts a real burden on a place like this. Walking around Kisiple, which is just a small town, it doesn't have a clinic, there's only one school, you can see people seeking refuge under any shade they can find. Equip Liberia, one of the main NGOs working in this area, says in many towns like this one, the Ivorians are outnumbering the local population by 3-1, and that is putting a strain on everybody. The situation is a role reversal of sorts. During the civil war in Liberia, hundreds of thousands of Liberians fled to Ivory Coast. More than anyone, Liberians know what it is like to experience brutal violence and live in fear. That is why they willingly open their doors to help their neighbours in this time of crisis. But for many villages, the sheer numbers are simply overwhelming. Just an hour from Kisiple, along a winding, dusty track, lies Kamplé, another village where Liberian families are hosting refugees. Samuel Kaur, the head of a family of 10, is housing and feeding 5 Ivorians in his small mud hut.
Well, you know, since the arrival of these people, you know,
since the arrival of these people, things have been very tough. Just in terms of providing food,
livelihood is very hard.
Hard in what way?
Yeah, because, you know,
The past year, we didn't have a good harvest, so foodstuffs are very hard. Before they came, we were cooking 6 cups a day. Now we're cooking 10 cups of rice. You can see the area where we were lodging them.
Can you show us?
Yeah, yeah.
So 5 of them are in this small hut.
Yeah, 5 of them are here.
Yes, 5 of them are here.
The old man was sleeping here, you know.
My grandmother was sleeping here before they came.
3/4 of the refugees are women and children. 3 in 10 kids under the age of 5 are arriving acutely malnourished or severely at risk. Standing by a generator, David Waynes, the head of the NGO Equip Liberia, says their main concerns now are health, sexual exploitation, sanitation, and the food supply into the future.
The population is triple what it usually is for these communities. So what will happen next? Maybe all the seed rice will be consumed. Maybe, you know, all the stalks that they have, which are supposed to carry them until the next harvest, will be consumed. Now, they never, ever in these villages make it to the next harvest anyway. They always need to supplement their harvest with more food that they can purchase.
Meanwhile, Ivorians and Liberians desperately wait for the United Nations Refugee Agency to set up refugee camps. But the camps are not expected to open for at least another month. After that, it's anyone's guess when the situation in Ivory Coast will stabilise enough so the camps can close and the Ivorians can go back home. For the World Vision Report, I'm Tamasin Ford in Nimba County, Liberia.
In India, many people rely on rickshaws to get around. Sure, they're old and they're slow, but they're also cheap and environmentally friendly. When reporter Peter Aronson moved to India 5 years ago, he at first recoiled at the idea of being pulled along by another human being.
I mean, why should they toil so that I don't have to? I took a bicycle rickshaw once when I had heat stroke, but I didn't feel good about it. Another time, I took one in Nepal because the taxis and buses were on strike. I felt embarrassed that one man's legs were working to pull me, my wife, our suitcases, and the big rickshaw down a dusty lane for 3 hours. But he didn't seem to mind at all. After a while, as my self-consciousness waned a bit, I noticed how pleasant it was, for us anyway, to ride slowly through the fields and past the water buffalo, making chit-chat with other bicycle riders along the way. Even so, I couldn't help but think of the hard work it was for the man doing the pedaling. A question rattled around in my mind. Was I exploiting him? In Patna, capital of the Indian state of Bihar, I got to hear the rickshaw puller side of the story. Most of them are uneducated. They work as farm laborers 2 or 3 months a year when there's work. But when the farming season's over, they come to the cities and drive bicycle rickshaws. On a good day, they can earn as much as 100 rupees, about $2, from 10 or 15 rides. That money keeps them above India's poverty line. India, as one economist pointed out to me, is a low-opportunity society. And Bihar, one of India's poorest states, is especially so. So the fact that these men can use their leg power to earn that $2 a day means at least they have some kind of opportunity. I'd always thought it was better to take an auto rickshaw, a three-wheeled vehicle that sounds like it's powered by a motorcycle or lawnmower engine. I mean, it gets you there faster and nobody has to sweat. But as someone in Patna rightly pointed out to me, bicycle rickshaws don't pollute. There are 100,000 rickshaws in Patna and 10 million in India. If they were all suddenly replaced by carbon-belching auto rickshaws, it would seriously hurt the environment. Plus, I was told, bicycle rickshaws aren't just for wealthy people to ride on and feel grand. When poor villagers come to cities to find a doctor, they can't afford motorized transport, but they can afford a few rupees for a rickshaw. Finally, there's the issue of age. Some of the rickshaw pullers look young and strong, but many are old, gray, and worn with age. I especially never wanted to subject these men to the work of pulling my weight. But then I met an older driver who told me how hard it is to see customers choose the younger drivers, even though he's still feeling strong and healthy. So now when I look at the bicycle rickshaws lined up on the curb, I still see a symbol of exploitation, but I also see an environmentally friendly form of transportation and a little bit of economic opportunity.
Peter Aronson is a freelance reporter based in northern India. They call him the Mozart of Madras, and like Mozart, composer A.R. Rahman started young. He was just 11 years old when he joined his first music troupe. He went on to be a favorite in Bollywood. Now he's a hit in Hollywood. He won 2 Oscars for Slumdog Millionaire, and he's just been nominated for another Oscar, this time for his work on the film 127 Hours. Music by Oscar nominee A.R. Rahman. To hear his performance at the 2010 Nobel Peace Prize concert, visit our website, worldvisionreport.org. Basketball players move fast from one side of the court to the other. They dive for the ball, knock opponents out of the way, and shoot. It sounds like your regular college hoops game, except that on this court in Laos, the players are in wheelchairs. Some of the players have lost the use of their limbs to polio or to weapons left over from the Vietnam War. The basketball court is a haven of sorts, away from the stares and the stigma that plague disabled people in Laos. Erwin Loy took in a basketball game in the capital of Vientiane, and he sent us this report.
It's already a warm evening in Vientiane, but on this court in the middle of a rehab center in the city, a game of wheelchair basketball is turning into a heated rivalry. The athletes sit in sleek chairs with the wheels angled in toward the seats. There's a scramble for the ball in the middle of the court. The players race into battle, their wheelchairs colliding. One of the quickest players on the court is Samnyang Tomavong. As he darts into the skirmish, he's thrown off balance and his chair tumbles over. The crowd murmurs as he uses his arm to push off the ground, then balances on the edge of the chair, bouncing it up and down with his right leg until he's steady again. Then he catapults himself down the court, back into the play.
Golf is a fantastic sport for people with disability. You know, we can meet friends, we can get together, we can, you know, make fun from the sport. That's wonderful, so I like it.
I catch up with Sam Nyang during a break in play. He plays for the men's wheelchair basketball team of Laos, at least when there's enough funding to send the squad to regional tournaments. He knows firsthand the difficulties of living with a disability in a developing country. Polio robbed him of the use of his left leg as a child.
You know, it's quite hard because, I could not make friends, you know. I just feel that I'm different from others. You know, I even feel that I am not fully human being or something.
Sam Nyang says even his relatives shunned him. They told him his family must have done something wrong in their previous lives. It's probably safe to say that nobody feels shunned in today's match. As the game starts up again, the ball comes to Liesl Tesch. She's one of a pair of visiting players from Australia. She has an athletic frame and a thunderous presence on the court. The wheels of her chair spin furiously as she propels herself down the floor with powerful lunges from her arms. Opposing players try to intercept. Their wheels scrape against her chair as she evades their checks. After the play, I track Tesch down on the sidelines. She wipes sweat away from her brow as she speaks hurriedly. She's eager to get back on the court.
I've been competing in wheelchair basketball for 21 years now, since I had a bicycle accident and broke my back when I was 19.
Tesch is a star athlete who has represented her country 5 times at the Paralympic Games, taking home 3 medals.
I think more than anything else, I'm shocking people to believe that anything's possible.
Tonight's game is organized by COPE, the Prosthetics and Orthotics Workshop, which offers services at this rehabilitation center, one of the few government-run options in the country where people with disabilities can turn to for help. For player Sam Nyang Tomavong, the sport has helped change his life. Today, he holds down a steady job making parts for wheelchairs, and he's looking forward to representing his country at a tournament in Indonesia next year.
Playing basketball is make me feel that, I'm not that so disabled. I can do something what I can do.
For the World Vision Report, I'm Erwin Loy in Vientiane, Laos.
You can see video of Paralympian Liesl Tesch on our website, worldvisionreport.org. Those basketball players might want to try some pinole. That's an energy-boosting drink that the indigenous Tarahumara people of Mexico have been downing for years. Tarahumara are famous for their long-distance running. Even their name tells the story. It translates as the running people. It's a skill developed over thousands of years as they ran between their scattered canyon villages. Today, they keep this running tradition alive through races that are sometimes more than 100 miles long. And that's where their traditional corn drink comes in. Mexico correspondent Grant Fuller hiked to an isolated cabin to see how pinole is made.
It all centers around a tall bag in the corner of a dark mud hut. It's full of a classic staple of the Mexican diet, corn grown and harvested on a humble family farm. Adelaida Marino scoops kernels out of the bag and pours them into a wide wicker basket. In the long tradition of Tarahumara running, pinole has always been there.
I like pinole. This is how my mother taught us to make it.
Pinole is a simple concoction. Really, it's just finely ground corn mixed with water. But there are many steps to achieving pinole perfection. First, you have to get out these pieces that are flying around, Marino says as she stands in the front yard, shaking the basket of corn up and down. She takes the corn inside to boil for 5 minutes and soften it up, while her husband, Corpus Estrada, watches from his bed a few feet away. He describes pinole like the Red Bull of the Tarahumara.
It gives you a little strength, and the corn fills you up fast. It's good for the stomach, and it helps you walk and everything. If you don't drink it, then you're not motivated to run or even to move a muscle.
Today, Estrada could hardly move a muscle even if he wanted to. He's exhausted from the 62-mile ultramarathon he and his son ran just yesterday. They drank pinole during the race because Tarahumara legend says this high-carb drink is the perfect endurance fuel. Estrada rests while his wife moves on to the next pinole step, toasting the corn. Marino pours it out of a bucket onto the flat surface of their comal, a wood-burning stove made from a steel barrel. She spreads the kernels around with a straw brush. Soon, the kernels start to whistle and jump around the comal. It smells like popcorn.
A ver si el gringo puede.
Let's see if the gringo can do it, I say as we move on to the grinder. I give it a few turns before Marino takes over. She has to grind the corn 3 times to get it ready for the metate, a heavy stone slab that's like a giant mortar and pestle.
Así se hace?
Sí.
Muy bien. Es un poco pesado, ¿no?
Sí.
I step in to give it a shot. The block is heavy and I can't quite get the hang of it. But Marino quickly finds a rhythm and somehow makes the metate sing.
Huele bien. Gracias. ¿Cuánto pongo?
After 6 steps and about an hour of work, the pinole is ready to drink. The delicious popcorn-like smell fills my nose as I drop a spoonful of the corn powder into a glass and mix it with water. You can also throw in some sugar and spice to give it extra kick. Estrada's son and fellow runner, 16-year-old Abelardo, gives me a tip. Drinking and mixing, drinking and mixing. That's the way you do it, he says, to keep the pinole from settling at the bottom of the glass. The whole family sits down to enjoy their daily pinole and ask Abelardo what he thinks.
¿Qué piensa del pinole? Muy bueno.
He says it's really good, it gives you energy. For running thousands and thousands of miles, right? I say.
Y millones y millones.
And millions and millions, he shoots back with a laugh. For the World Vision Report, I'm Grant Fuller near Bahuichivo, Mexico.
You can see how pinole is made. There are photos on our website, worldvisionreport.org. Just ahead on the World Vision Report, making music with an mbira. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Melinda Pencava. Freezing cold weather has kept many of us indoors these last few weeks, but for the brave few who venture out, the rewards can be sweet. In big cities, street vendors sell everything from steaming hot chocolate to your favorite kind of cupcake. And it's true as well in South Korea. The winter streets there are filled with a warm and inviting aroma. Roasted chestnuts. They're a traditional Korean food, and while Koreans these days are eating less of other traditional foods like rice, roasted chestnuts remain as popular as ever. Michael Ri has this street vendor story from Seoul.
The sun is beginning to set on this Friday night in Daegu. It's below freezing, but the neighborhood's buzzing with families and teenagers hustling to restaurants, coffee houses, and theaters. In the midst of all this action is a small stand that appears to be steaming. This is Hongkyung Chan's roasted chestnut stand. In front of it, hundreds of shiny brown chestnuts are on display. Little children bundled in hats and scarves look longingly as they walk by.
You put the chestnuts in here.
Hong pours a couple handfuls of raw chestnuts in a rotating metal cylinder. Underneath it is a steady flame. After a few minutes, the chestnuts begin to snap like popcorn as their shells come off. Hong has been selling roasted chestnuts on this street every winter for the past 10 years.
I used to eat these when I was a boy. And long ago, my grandfather and his grandfather ate these. Koreans eat them in the winter to stay warm, but they're also good for you in a lot of ways and are supposed to ward off colds.
Hong says he can sell an entire 90-pound bag's worth in one day if business is good. But the roasted chestnut has a lot of competition these days. Look around Hong's stand and you can see KFC, Starbucks, Krispy Kreme, and other fast food chains tempting the taste buds of Korean consumers. Foods like these have cut the population's consumption of age-old standbys like rice by as much as 25% over the past decade. But according to the country's Farm Institute, Koreans are eating just as many chestnuts now as they were 10 years ago.
There's no rule for who eats chestnuts. Adults, grandma, grandpa, even kids. You'll see families walking by to get some for their children. And right then, it makes an impression on a child's taste. And so when they grow up, they'll feed chestnuts to their children, and so on.
But could this tradition ever change? Hong says, impossible. One of his customers, Yang Young Shin, agrees.
It's like when tourists come here and try Korean food. They like it, but they still have their own tastes and preferences. We're the same way. Foreign foods are okay, but chestnuts are like other traditional Korean foods, like soybean stew and kimchi. You grow up eating it, and it's just good. And expensive, too. $3 for this little sack? I must love them.
Hong says there isn't a specific date on the calendar when he closes down his chestnut stand. When the air gets warmer and sales start to slide, he just gets that feeling again that roasted chestnut season is over. For the World Vision Report, I'm Michael Rhee in Seoul.
By the time she was four, Zimbabwean singer Chiwaniso was playing the imbira. The Shona of Zimbabwe have been plunking this kind of a thumb piano in religious ceremonies for thousands of years, but it was only the men who played it. Chiwaniso is helping to change that tradition. Here, she's playing the imbira on her most recent album, Rebel Woman. Our guide to world music, Ishma Fundekwa, spoke with the World Vision Report's Lita Hartman about Chiwaniso.
Welcome to the program, Ish. It's great to talk to you.
Thanks, Lita. It's always good to be on the program.
So we just heard a cut from Chiwaniso's latest record, which is called Rebel Woman. Tell me a little bit about her and how she got started in music.
Chiwaniso was born in 1976 in a town called Olympia in Washington State. Her father, Jumi Maraire, was an ethnomusicologist and a music teacher at a university in Washington State. And since, I think, age four, Chiwaniso has been playing music. And her father specialized in teaching the mbira and the marimba. And Chiwaniso and her family came back to Zimbabwe after independence in the early 80s. She started playing her music, getting serious about her music.
Tell us about these instruments and their role in traditional Zimbabwean music.
In Zimbabwe, the mbira is used as traditionally they used it at ceremonies to communicate with the spirits. At these ceremonies, women were not allowed to play the mbira. They had their own role at these ceremonies, and it was only the men who could play the mbira. But it was also used in entertainment. The men would play it when they went hunting, and so it's a very, very traditional African instrument.
Have you ever been to this kind of ceremony that you're describing?
Oh, yeah, I've been. I've been to quite a few of them.
And what are they like?
You feel connected. Yeah, they're really fascinating. And you see people being possessed by the spirits, speaking in tongues sometimes, and things could be going wrong in a family, for instance, and then, you know, just to appease the spirits, they'll have a ceremony like this.
And can you see the roots of that, the threads of that in current popular music?
Well, you know what? When people go to listen to people like Thomas Mapfumo, for instance, when a lot of people go to these gigs, they're like, well, you know, we're going to a bira. I think the music has done a lot in conscientizing, especially the urban people, especially the youth, about tradition, because then people start asking questions, what is going on here? You should see the number of kids today who are learning to play the mbira, whereas before it was looked upon as dismissed as one of those primitive instruments and everybody wanted to play the guitar. But right now, there's a rush of all these kids trying to play Dembira because of people like Chuoniso, because of people like Thomas Mapfumo, people like Stella Chiweshe. It has become acceptable. It has become fashionable to play Dembira.
How did it come about that Chuoniso learned to play it? How did she break through that barrier?
By the time that Chuoniso came back to Zimbabwe, there were already a few women who were playing Dembira. We have women like Stella Chiweshe, Beulah Jgoko, who started playing Dembira. And I think in the beginning it was like, wow, what do you think you're doing? You're not supposed to do that. But these were real pioneers. For people like Chuoniso, I think it was much easier because these people had cleared the way for her.
We are going to listen to an example of Chiwaniso's Mbira playing. It's called Neme Musasa. Can you tell us a little bit about this song, Ish?
Neme Musasa is a traditional song. It's like a standard that any wannabe Mbira player has to know how to play Neme Musasa. Of course, initially it was just played with the Mbira and maybe with the hosho, the rattles. But here there's a lot of Western instrumentation as well.
Okay, let's hear it. Dish that Chiwaniso decided to go back to the country of her family's origin. What did she get up to musically there?
Chiwaniso has collaborated with people from all over the world, really. And with her being born in the United States, I think it opened up a lot of barriers for her. And growing up, she also told me once that, you know, it wasn't just Mbira music in their home. It wasn't just African or Shona music. There was everything. There was James Brown, there was Sly and the Family Stone, there was Aretha Franklin. They listened to everything. And Chiwaniso, I think one of her breakthrough moments was when she was with a group called A Piece of Ebony, which was a local hip-hop band that did extremely well.
We're going to listen to a tune from A Piece of Ebony called Vadzimu. You can really hear that hip-hop and rap in there big time.
Allons tout le monde, allons aux discothèques. Voulez-vous en France, voulez-vous en Afrique. Voulez-vous me voir, voulez-vous que je m'explique. Allons. Allons tout le monde, allons aux discothèques. Voulez-vous en France, voulez-vous en Afrique. Voulez-vous me voir, voulez-vous que je m'explique. Allons.
What's different about her style of music versus what would be considered really straight traditional music?
Traditional music, traditional Zimbabwean Mbira music, it would be like just the Mbira, the voices, and maybe the hosho, which is the rattles, and a lot of singing. It's a kind of music that would get you into a trance. It can get very deep and very sublime, you know?
So Ish, tell me the different languages that Chiwaniso sings in.
Chiwaniso sings primarily in Shona, because her music is, or the roots of her music are Shona. About 85% of the people in Zimbabwe speak Shona. And then she also sings in English.
Okay, let's listen to a track from her latest release, Rebel Woman, called Pamaromo.
Paruna, aha.
Well, that's a typical example of Mbira music. You just heard a drum there and the voices, you know, Chiwoniso and some men in the background. And that's typical Shona Mbira music. And that song is also a traditional song called Pamoromo about a woman called Haruna with a big mouth. And that's the music in its almost purest form. And sometimes, you know, that's what I really want to listen to when I'm at home and not out dancing.
So, Ish, how has Chiwoniso's music continued to evolve over the years?
I think Chiwoniso's music has taken so many twists and turns because we listen to the hip-hop stuff and then we listen to some of the stuff from a earlier album, and she's been with so many bands, and even lately as she travels she's talking about collaborating with people from other parts of the world, adding various instruments, more instrumentation to her music. So I don't think we can say that what we're listening to is the final product. I think she's still a work in progress. Chiwoniso is only 33, so I think there's a lot more to come from her.
You've met her. Can you tell us what she's like in person and what people in Zimbabwe think about her?
She's a real wonderful person. I've interviewed her a few times. I've been to her performances, and I've been to some very intimate performances where we were at friend's house, mutual friend's place, and she brought along Mbira and just started jamming, just started playing by herself. And she's really driven by her music. Like I say, there's still a lot to come from this young woman.
We're going to go out on a song that actually is pretty upbeat, and maybe you could tell us what the title means.
Nguwa Yekufara means time to be happy. You know, what she's saying here is that what she's saying is that the time to be happy is more important than the time to be sad. And hey, let me get up and dance because it's time to be happy. Ndiyo nguva yangu rega zvakadaro nguva yemafaro siyandi tambe inguva yangu.
Something to carry people through the troubled times, at least.
Absolutely. I mean, you see a lot of that in Zimbabwe at the moment. When people go to live gigs, it's like they check their troubles at the door.
You know, we don't really necessarily think of people going out, celebrating, partying, seeing pop concerts.
Zimbabweans still go out and they have fun when they can afford to. And it's like there's all these challenges that we're facing in this country at the moment. But a lot of the times people say, okay, maybe it's Saturday night tonight, we're going out. And they check their troubles at the door and go in and have a good time, and they'll deal with whatever comes tomorrow, when tomorrow comes.
Let me practice the little Shona that I know and say, Ndotenda Shamwari. And can you translate for us, please? What did I just say?
Yeah, what you just said is, thank you, my friend. And Neni Ndotenda, I thank you too.
Ish Mufundekwa is our world music tour guide. He spoke to us from his home in Harare, Zimbabwe.
Ingua ye kufara huya mudiwa.
And that's this week's World Vision Report. At our website, worldvisionreport.org, you can download podcasts, read blogs, and post your comments. We're always interested in feedback about the show. Our program is produced by Beverly Abel. Lita Hartman is the assignment editor. Christina Darden, Cynthia Graber, and Sue Shepherd are our producers. Chris Baldiga is our production assistant. Doug Boyles is our sound engineer. Emily Eagle is our engineering assistant. And sitting in for Peggy Waymire, I'm Melinda Pencava.
Support for this program comes from World Vision, building a better world for children. The views expressed on this show are not necessarily those of the organization.
Tired and dusty, she sat by the road, her green spotted uniform and her sneakers outworn. Rebel woman, yeah. Rebel woman, yeah. She took off her hat and she leaned against a tree, her rifle by her side, rough worn hands upon her knee. Rebel woman, yeah. Rebel woman. Inde, 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 wele. Inde, inde.